Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 263, An Intuitive Approach to Treating Trauma, with Dr. Sage Breslin. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So I started to think about the idea of sending somebody back through time to a very traumatic event. And although I was physically in the room with them as they were telling the story, it's as if that connection to the trauma didn't relinquish. So I started to think about other forms of therapies I'd done with people, and I started to think about my intuitive training. And I asked one of the folks that I'd been working with for quite some time, who was recovering from sexual trauma, if it would be, if she'd be willing to allow me to go back through time with her.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Sage Breslin, speaking about the way she incorporates intuition into her work with patients suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Sage Breslin, Ph.D., is a licensed California psychologist and consultant with nearly two decades of diverse experience. She did her doctoral work at Northwestern University and went on to do postdoctoral study at Harvard. She reports that she has lived and worked in all regions of the United States and in Europe, developing an appreciation for many cultures, languages, faiths, and personal and professional styles. Dr. Breslin works both with individuals and consults to corporate executives. Her individual work has frequently focused on trauma recovery. As a consultant, Dr. Breslin works primarily with corporate executives and high-security government personnel. She has provided forensic evaluation, assessment, debriefing, and consultation to all branches of the armed services, as well as to employees of other security organizations. While trained analytically, Dr. Breslin reports that she now infuses traditional training with contemporary, innovative techniques for a powerful transformational approach. Dr. Breslin has also taught at both college and graduate school levels for nearly a decade. She also speaks on such diverse issues as domestic violence, sexual trauma, integrative medicine, intuition, stress management, women's issues, infertility, and eating disorders. She says her real passion, though, lies in the transformational journeys that she leads in the United States and Mexico through her Beyond Insight program. Dr. Breslin has also published numerous articles and has a book entitled Lovers and Survivors, Living with and Loving a Sexual Abuse Survivor. And she has authored inspirational chapters in a number of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Beyond this, she has both authored and edited over three dozen courses for the Zur Institute, providing online continuing education courses for clinicians worldwide. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Sage Breslin, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, I'm very happy to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. You and I have only one degree of separation, in as much as I guess you've been working with Ofer Zur and his online CE program, continuing education program for professionals, the Zur Institute. And I gather you've created courses of your own as well as editorial assistance on many others. And as you probably know, I've got two courses of my own in this catalog.
I do. In fact, I have a course on positive psychology that you created that I'm halfway through, and just delighted with the quality and content that you've been providing. So I'm happy to be having this conversation with you today.
Oh, excellent. Well, I think maybe you and I will want to have a conversation after this. Apart from the interview, I'd like to know more about what you're doing there, and maybe there might be ways that you could help me get more course content up there since I've been slow to add more courses.
Happy to.
Okay. So, you know, I'm very interested in the work that you've been doing. Now, you got your doctoral degree at Northwestern University. What was that in?
I did that in counseling psychology. I think there are a lot of folks who know what clinical psychology is, but probably fewer, at least fewer on the West Coast, that know what counseling psychology is.
Well, do you want to say a word about what it is?
Sure. In clinical psychology, the general rule of thumb is to evaluate the patient and determine what it is that needs to kind of be taken away from the patient in order to help them function better or feel better. And in counseling psychology, we actually believe that most problems come from something called illness of fit between the person and the environment. And oftentimes, it really only takes morphing the environment or creating new circumstances for the clients to feel much better. Certainly, there are some caveats and some diagnostic categories that probably wouldn't be suitable for counseling psychology when there are organic brain issues or medication requirements. But in many of the circumstances where people seek out counseling, they are really best addressed by counseling psychologists.
Okay. And then after you finished up your PhD, I gather sometime afterwards, I don't know if it was immediately after or some time went by, you enrolled in some sort of special program at Harvard. Maybe you can tell us what that was about.
Yeah. I'd been compiling sort of interventions and techniques on my own to improve the level and variety in my work. And what I determined was that some of the interventions that I'd been using, there were other people who were also using them. And at the time, which was about 8 years ago, Harvard Medical Center had a wonderful program for mind-body training with Herb Benson at the helm. And I had a great opportunity to go to Harvard Medical Center, to their institute there, and complete the certification in mind-body medicine. And I love my plaque. It's wonderful. But I also discovered that what I was doing was a little bit more cutting-edge and broader than even what they were offering there. So it was an interesting experience. It was very validating in many different ways, and I learned probably much more about the history of what I was doing. It was a great experience, though.
Yes, and Herbert Benson certainly is a familiar name to me as the person who, I guess, was inspired initially by all the rave reports that were coming out about transcendental meditation. And so he sort of stripped it down to its basics and gave people the mantra of one to focus on. And really, you know, I think that launched a whole wave of research on meditation that's still ongoing today with lots of very interesting findings in relation to brain correlates and so on. So I gather after that program, it sort of puts your career on a rather interesting trajectory over, I guess, nearly 20 years, starting out as a rather traditional therapist and over time morphing into what might be called a medical or psychological intuitive?
Correct.
Okay, well, why don't you take us through that evolution to get us started?
Sure. Well, lots of people ask me, what does the word intuitive mean? They have a sense it means, sort of being able to read people better than others or what have you. And I actually break the word down for them and just pronounce it into it. It's when you train your skills to get into it or get into somebody's, I guess the psychologist maybe would say get into their psyche. Sometimes I get into their story. Mostly I just have learned to get into their energy. And without sound incredibly woo-woo. You know, I was just one of those lucky people. I was born with a certain set of skills, and my parents have those skills, and my grandparents have those skills. My brother has a modified version of those skills. And over time, what happened was I felt like it was more out of control, like too much information all the time. And I finally decided that what I most wanted to do was to learn how to control these skills and be able to use intuition in a way that it was helpful. And not just helpful to me, but helpful to the clients I was seeing, helpful to the people around me. So I trained as a medical intuitive. I worked as a medical intuitive for 2 years after a 5-year training with two different masters in the field. Both had different skill sets, and so I got a really nice, broad opportunity and education to develop all of my senses. And I still functioned as a very traditional psychologist at the time, and it did probably take me another 5 years to utilize my intuition in the course of treating patients and in the course of therapy. And I do provide something called, you know, intuitive psychotherapy. There are other people who do it. When I provide it, I don't do that unless that's exactly what the client wants. I do some intuitive consultation when asked, mostly missing persons. And I try to follow my intuition in the course of therapy when treating people, when it can allow them to overcome hurdles that they can't overcome in any other way, when they can't do that spontaneously.
Well, I'm familiar with the notion of medical intuitives, such as Edgar Cayce and Carolyn, I want to say Miss, but I've been told it's Mace.
Yeah, Mace.
I don't know how you get Mace from M-Y-S-S. Would you say that you're more or less in that lineage, only with maybe more of a psychological than a medical orientation?
Yes, I actually, one of the masters that trained me actually went on to work for Carolyn. And so I would say I definitely have qualities that are Carolyn-esque, and I would hope that would be a great compliment to her. And when I went on to work as a medical intuitive, I simply learned to use my skills to detect disease, injury, illness in the body, and then communicate with the client, but also oftentimes with their medical team in order to help them approach certain issues that were coming up for them.
Well, as you talk, I'm remembering now that I interviewed psychiatrist Judy Orloff about her book, Emotional Freedom, and she also draws heavily upon psychic intuition and talks about, you know, how her childhood and how she was having these sorts of experiences. Are you familiar with her or her work at all?
Yeah, gently so. Gently so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I need to be upfront with you that I waver a bit between skepticism and credulity on these sorts of matters. On the one hand, I'm willing to be a pragmatist and say, hey, if it works, I'm all for it. I think a wide variety of both traditional and non-traditional approaches depend upon recruiting the client's powers of hope and self-healing, that to some degree all of psychotherapy is shamanic, if you will, that the practitioner's enthusiasm and belief and so on count for a lot. At the same time, and I noticed that in the notes that you sent me, too, that you mentioned training in Toltec wisdom. So I have to tell you, I'm skeptical of Toltec wisdom because it's my understanding that the actual Toltec people have been long gone. Another one of my previous interviews was with Alan Hardman, who describes himself as a relationship coach, author, teacher, and quotes Toltec master, trained by Miguel Ruiz in the tradition of the Four Agreements. I think I was open with him that I have a little trouble with the self-description of quotes Toltec master. So I just wanted to be upfront about this. I'm sort of on the fence. And having said that, I am interested in having you tell us more about your work, especially in the realm of treating trauma.
Absolutely. Well, in response to Toltec, I wouldn't consider myself a Toltec master because it's not the only foundational body that I use. I like to think that what I understand the Toltecs is that they have always been seekers, and they do still exist. They're not like the Mayans who died out or the Aztecs who came and went. It's simply a description of seekers of truth. And the four agreements are great because they are simply four easy to live by instructions that do help keep things simpler. But are the only four things that I use? No. But they're a wonderful little, Toltec Bible, if you will, that allow people to just simplify their lives and not get so caught up in what other people think and what other people are doing. They've really just engaged the person to stay oriented to reality.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff, just makes sense, and you kind of read
Absolutely.
It and you say, well, of course, it's kind of somehow fits with what might be called the perennial wisdom.
Yes, and I think there is a huge movement that's been happening during the last 5 to 10 years where what we see is a lot of the contemporary theories and offerings all point in the same direction.
I agree.
Simply, let's focus on how we interact as a community. Let's focus on the skills and tools that we came in with. Modify and hone as you go, certainly, but keep it simple. So, and the same is, I would say, in the treatment and the management of trauma, there's a lot of that I utilize.
Well, tell us more about your work with trauma. What are the elements of your current approach?
So my current approach to trauma, I would call an SOS model, and it's not save our souls, not exactly.
Okay.
Is sort of following safety, order, and security. And when we look at managing a global crisis or an act of God or an act of war, or even into the more localized trauma, like a car accident or derailment, midair disaster, something like that, the very first thing people need to orient to is, am I safe? And our first responders are really the folks who become responsible for making sure there's physical integrity, making sure that if somebody's injured, they get help. If they need to go to a hospital to invoke safety, then they do that. So safety is always the first element. And I think what we have really experienced in the crisis in Japan is a whole world looking at this and not just saying, is Japan safe, but are we safe? And really feeling very focused, nearly to the point of obsession with, How is this impacting everyone? And a lot of folks trying to go a lot of different avenues to make sure that they're safe.
Right, like people rushing to purchase the potassium iodine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And clearing out the shelves of all sea vegetables and fish and so on and so forth.
Right.
So that safety is really just the most important part of what we do. And then order comes around. You have to be able to orient to your world. Part of that orientation is to make sure that you create whatever structure you can that allows for a sense of normalcy. Again, to look at examples of Japan, it's been very difficult to engage in normalcy because they're still on that first avenue of, are we safe yet? But people do things like, do I have all my children? Do I have my possessions? Can I go to work? Is there transportation available? They just begin to create the structure that they would use if things were normal. The second item in terms of ordering their world is that they have to create a setting that some boundaries so that you can have some comfortable function. You have to say, okay, is there a way I can wake up and eat and go to sleep at some regular times? Let me try to create some normalcy. And performing the activities of daily living as well as other kinds of activities to help you feel more normal. After something like a tsunami, part of the normal is, okay, at some point in time, I have to have a place to sleep. How much debris can I clear away? Can I get clothing for myself or my children? It's an ordering. And then the last element of that section is control what you can and do what you can. So, for instance, some part of that control is, as you said, people rushing to the shelves. But we've also had wonderful programs springing up the world over for things like Socks for Japan. You know, this is something I can do today. I can get these socks. I can put them in the mail. I can send them to this address. And I've now done something. I don't feel so helpless.
Right. Now, I'm glad that you brought up Japan, because that's something that I wanted to talk about. And I'd like to come back to it. But I'd like to start more locally now, because I know that, for example, you've worked with people who are suffering from sexual trauma, let's say, from rape and so on.
Yeah.
So what would be the elements of your SOS approach? How would that be grounded in working with an individual?
Sure. Well, mostly people come for therapy when they get to that final S, which is security. So they've tried to engage as much security as they can on their own, and they've discovered that they still don't feel safe. And they begin to look at the trauma themselves and try to determine, how am I still living this? And that's oftentimes when I see combat veterans or I see sexual trauma survivors. They've been able to get to safety. They've created some order in their lives, but they can't feel secure. They don't feel like themselves anymore. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like this day is any different than the day in which they were traumatized or injured. So that's where we look at utilizing other kinds of therapies inside the therapy room to really help them gain a sense of security. And we have things like prolonged exposure therapy that was founded by Edna Foa.
Yes, yes. I interviewed her as well, by the way.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So, you know, that approach is kind of a CBT and a relaxation training and talk therapy all at the same time. So if you could take a psychodynamic therapist and then add Erin Beck and add her Benson into the mold, you'd get something that looked like prolonged exposure therapy.
Right.
Then you have someone like Francine Shapiro, who is the founder of EMDR.
Who I've also interviewed. I can't help but be a name dropper here.
I love that. Yeah. And so she effectively looks at, how can we change how the body experiences trauma and reset itself, really. It's changing those neural pathways. So as I learn to do this work and infuse it with a more intuitive approach, what I discovered was missing from the mind-body medicine that I learned with Herb Benson was the spirit portion, because in the beginning, mind-body-spirit was where we were trying to head.
Mm-hmm.
So without wanting to be overtly religious, because I'm very spiritual, but I'm no longer religious, and not wanting to eliminate or omit anyone who didn't have a structured religious faith, I began to look at the elements of prolonged exposure therapy that didn't work or weren't as effective for the people I was seeing. And what I discovered was that every time they tried to do their prolonged exposure therapy, they felt re-traumatized.
This is as you were taking them in their imagination, reliving the experience?
Yes, exactly. So anytime they retold their story and allowed themselves to actually feel what was happening during the traumatic situation and experience what was happening in the traumatic situation, they in fact would be re-traumatized. Their cortisol levels would shoot back up. They would feel shaky. They would get depressed after the session. And initially, I thought, gosh, maybe I'm just doing this wrong. You know, I know I've learned this, but maybe I'm doing it wrong. And then I started to really think about, well, why would they feel any different? Because, sure, you can tell a story over and over again and pray that, you know, you won't be quite as emotional every time you tell a story, but why not? So I started to think about the idea of sending somebody back through time to a very traumatic event. And although I was physically in the room with them as they were telling the story, it's as if that connection to the trauma didn't relinquish. So I started to think about other forms of therapies I'd done with people, and I started to think about my intuitive training And I asked one of the folks that I'd been working with for quite some time who was recovering from sexual trauma if it would be, if she'd be willing to allow me to go back through time with her to this event. And she looked at me funny and she said, yeah, but how are you going to do that? You weren't there. And I said, well, you know, being intuitive is kind of a funny thing because there's part of me that does see things the way you see them, and sometimes with such incredible accuracy that I can locate a missing person right down to the street. So, you know, would you give it a try? And she said, well, sure. You know, I can't see any way in which it would be harmful. I'm going to do this therapy anyway. So this time the instruction that I gave to her was as she was telling the story, and as she located the trauma, and as she envisioned herself in the scene, I asked her to turn around and see me behind her. And she kind of looked at me quizzically before we started, and I said, just try it. It's either going to work or it's not going to work, and I'm okay either way. And the effect of her envisioning me behind her, whether or not it was through her own imagination, or whether it was that she energetically took me to the scene, she began to relax. And she began to relax because she was not alone.
Well, I have to say that this makes, quotes, intuitive sense to me. It really fits with some other approaches. For example, hypnotherapy, which I was very involved with back when I was in practice, and psychosynthesis, which uses a lot of very imaginative techniques. And so, you know, I've done guided imagery and things where, you know, I close my eyes too, and I really picture it, and I really feel like I'm accompanying that person on the journey. So I can really relate to what you're saying.
Yeah, well, and it does make some real rational sense if you think that one of the most debilitating elements of PTSD and of depression is a sense of isolation, then perhaps one of the missing links was somebody being there, you know, an end to the isolation.
Yes, yes.
So I began to incorporate that. And I've really incorporated it broadly in my work with trauma survivors and discovered that suddenly their symptoms lessened much more quickly. And I saw that as a good sign. And they saw that as a good sign.
Yeah, I would think so.
Sure. So by utilizing a really broad variety of elements in my treatment and not trying to just stick with one treatment or another treatment, I've become highly effective with people who have suffered trauma and have really been enduring their symptoms mostly in silence and in isolation.
Would it be possible for you to give us a kind of a case example, you know, disguising the person's name and so on?
Sure, just basically providing you more detail than, for instance, the woman I referred to before. I can give you the case of a combat veteran that I worked with who had actually been through a full prolonged exposure therapy program inpatient, was really quite badly traumatized, not only by to what he saw in combat, but was also injured significantly in combat. And he came back and went through this inpatient program and just really didn't feel much better. I think that, you know, he had to give it a shot. He wanted very much for his life to change, but he recognized that really all he wanted to do was self-medicate. He couldn't seem to soothe himself into any kind of position that was useful for him. His function was declining. He wasn't sleeping at all. He was finding he couldn't control his emotions very well. So he got my name from another combat vet who had worked with me and came in. He was he's in a branch of the military, that he's very stoic and pretty darn skeptical, I'd say, and had really felt like, you know, I've done it all, and I'm not getting better, and I'm never going to feel better. So I explained to him that the way I did this therapy, it was just slightly different. And I talked with him about his background, and I talked with him about what had happened to him during the course of combat. And I also asked him, you know, do you have any historical belief in God or religion? Are you, you know, is there somewhere you go to worship? Do you, and you know, it's a fairly normal question in the course of therapy. We want to know, where do you get your fellowship? Who's supporting you? And he said, you know, I'm kind of struggling with that because I feel like, yes, I was raised Christian, but you know, where was God when I was getting injured? And I said, well, I just wanted to know, you know, if he appears somewhere along the way, you know, she just let me know. He could be helpful. And it was just to plant a seed that sometimes we need to see ourselves as greater than something singular and human.
Yeah, and there's a lot of evidence to support that.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I also wanted him just to realize that that might include just me for the time being, mm-hmm. you know, human to human.
Sure.
So we began to do the prolonged exposure therapy. He began to tell his story. I watched his symptoms. He was very uncomfortable. His voice started to shake. His breathing became rapid. And he began sweating and mopping his brow and saying, I don't like this part. You know, I wish I could just numb out. And I said, I'm just going to have you stop there and look at me and really look in my eyes and know I am right here with you. You know, has anybody ever done that before? And he said, well, there was always a therapist with me, and the therapist was always focused on me. You know, it wasn't as if she left the room. And I said, well, that's great, but I need you to just feel that I'm here in the room with you. And he kind of looked at me quizzically and, again, very skeptical. And he said, okay, yeah, I mean, I can feel myself here with you. And I said, okay, now let's go back. He went all the way back to this scene that was most traumatic for him. And I said, now, as much as you may not want me there, I want you to turn around and see me sitting on the floor behind you. And he looked at me, and the tears started to flow, and he said, I don't want you there. You could get hurt. I said, it's okay. I'm not taking my body back with me. I'm just going to go energetically. Whether you believe in that or not, that's what's going to happen. And he looked down at the floor again, and the emotions started to roll, and every once in a while, during the course of that traumatic scene, I just reminded him, it's okay to look over your shoulder. See, I'm right there. Not a problem. I'm okay. I can shimmer. Bullets don't hurt me. So, slowly but surely, I brought him back up from the trauma, and he looked at me, and he had this big smile that came across. And he said, you know, I am in the habit of protecting people. And I said, well, I know that. You know, you're a soldier. And he said, but I didn't feel protected then. And I said, I know that.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You're a trauma survivor. And he said, well, that was really different this time. And I said, I know that. And he said, it wasn't so bad after all. And I said, why do you think that was? He said, I just knew I wasn't alone.
Uh-huh. And so you found that this the same sort of process has worked with person after person.
Yes. And in fact, sometimes the trauma survivors that I see do, like this combat veteran, come from personal referral, you know, word of mouth referral. And so they know something's different about what I do. And oftentimes they'll say, can you do that thing where we go back in time? Can you go with me? And so many of these people that I see, they're not, you know, what I would call woo-woos or mystics. They're not the folks who you might think of. They're just normal folks, and they may not believe at all in anything like clairvoyance or intuition, or they might believe in the gut instinct. They might believe in a mother's instinct. But generally speaking, they don't come ready to buy into me as an intuitive. They just know there's something different that I do when it comes to trauma recovery. Mm-hmm.
Do you encounter people for whom this does not work?
Well, I'm going to invite it to keep on working. So far, I've not come across anybody.
Okay.
I'm sure that there will be people who I work with who just are resistant to really embodying the trauma, really to go back with anything but their mind. And I think this particular modification of prolonged exposure therapy works best when they can invest in the spirit component or in the energy component. I think when they can really take all of themselves and maybe even, you know, most of me back, it seems to work better. Mm-hmm. And I think as I've honed my own skills in this particular modification, I see it working better and better.
You know, I've had other guests who are advocates of approaches like EFT, emotional freedom technique. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, the tapping along with the going back and imagining. And they claim very dramatic recovery from PTSD in just a few sessions. And so I'm thinking about Japan and the disaster over there. And I would think that would be, you know, a perfect test ground for those claims. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think, number one, as the Japanese people and as the people who are in Japan during this last crisis are able to really invoke their safety and feel some sense of order and then begin looking to ways to feel more secure, I think EFT is wonderful. I think EMDR is wonderful. I think even just acupuncture, which they already have, can be very, very useful in the release of trauma. And I mean, it would be my hope that there would be opportunities for those of us who would love to work with, you know, anyone involved in large-scale disaster to try out these techniques in order to release them from what can be a lifetime of symptoms. And the symptoms of PTSD are...
Yeah, I couldn't help but wonder if I or you or other psychologists could be of any use as volunteers over there, you know, given that I don't speak Japanese. I don't know if you do or not.
I don't, no.
But I'm wondering if there are maybe sorts of interventions that could be done on a group scale that could, you know, that there might be powerful interventions that are outside of traditional models. Do you have any
Absolutely.
Ideas about that or intuitive feelings about that?
I know that there have been in the past groups that have used large group meditation.
Okay.
Toning. There are a lot of the music therapies that you could do with 30,000 people if you had the right kind of area to gather and you had the right kind of speaker system. That basically create the relaxation response that Herb Benson taught us all in a bioenergetic way. It helps for the body to relax. So there's certain tones that you can even tone, and the body will relax in response to them.
So when you say toning, I've heard that, but I haven't experienced it. Is that the whole group then sort of chanting a tone, or is it one person striking a tone and everybody listening?
You know, there are a variety. So there are crystal toning bowls where you take a rod and you move it around the bowl, and it's just like when you put a wet finger around a crystal glass.
Okay.
And it makes a sound.
Yeah.
There are actually now very large toning bowls, and in fact, in Teotihuacan outside of Mexico City where the pyramids are, on specific holy days or sacred days there could be as many as 100, 200, or even 300 priests or priestesses there toning at different tones in order to create some vibration that's healing or a harmonic that's healing. That's one form. The Tibetans have toning bowls, which you've probably seen.
Mm-hmm.
There are toning chimes, bells, but there are also things like chanting, mantra. Those are all forms of toning. And people can even tone or keen with their voices and can learn to do sounds just up from the diaphragm that can create relaxation and release in the body.
I actually have a potential guest that's been pursuing me for some time, and I probably should go ahead and and do that interview.
I would encourage you to.
Yeah, because she's
really
written,
because of what you said. Because if we have a large-scale disaster mm-hmm. and we are trying to help people invoke some sense of security and some calm, we need big efforts. And you can't always just take 20,000 psychologists and transplant them and do one-on-one therapy or even small group therapy. Sometimes you need to be able to do something that can affect 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 people at a time.
Yeah, or even 20.
Let's shoot those numbers up there.
Yeah, 10
but
or 20.
But you also think there are probably things like EFT and EMDR and meditations and guided imageries. All of those things can be used in a large-scale audience for benefit.
Yes, and I would think that the fact of other people being there, too, would also be very supportive.
Absolutely. Even Tai Chi masters who can get up and lead Tai Chi or Qigong or mm-hmm. yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Again, all forms of release for the body so that the symptoms don't quickly get hooked in and stay hooked.
Yeah, and I would think that the Japanese in particular would be receptive to some of these sorts of approaches, particularly ones that might, as you suggest, be rooted in Asian cultures. Now, we're starting to run a little short on time, but what you've been saying kind of leads naturally into the fact that I noticed that you lead journeys in various parts of the country. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about those.
I do. One of the things I noticed especially with trauma survivors, I see it with probably all people, but trauma survivors tend to keep themselves pretty closed up unless they're in the therapy room because their symptoms are really difficult. And that's particularly challenging if they're coming in on their lunch hour and they've got 45 minutes and then they've got to go back to work. What I notice is that they really don't do the extent of the work they need to do to feel release, to feel comfort, to feel relaxation. So I started to think about utilizing a retreat model that would be from 4 to 7 days in length and to allow them to offload their material and keep themselves open for a number of days where they could do depth work and then slowly but surely put them back together in an order that made sense to them, and then return them home. So I do that in places that are have a wonderful energy to them so that I don't have to work so hard.
And typically, how many people would be involved in a workshop like that?
Anywhere from 5 to 25. It depends on who I'm working with and on what kinds of issues are coming into the group. On just a normal journey where people want to kind of revamp and revise, probably a group of 18 to 25 would be fine. When I know I'm working on very, very challenging traumatic circumstances with everyone in the group, then typically I won't go beyond 10 or 12. I really want to give it my individual attention.
Do you have a website where people could find you to learn more about the services that you offer?
Absolutely. It's www.healingheartcenter.org.
Healingheartcenter.org. Great. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And so we should probably wrap it up here. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Don't wait for tomorrow.
Okay. Well, that's short.
Today, life is short.
Yeah.
Yes. If you've been struggling on your own, today's the day. Pick up the phone, make a phone call, start somewhere.
Okay, well, that's good advice. Dr. Sage Breslin, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Sage Breslin. I was particularly intrigued by the way she encourages her PTSD patients to imagine or sense that she is with them as they return in their imagination to the scene of the trauma. As she points out, part of what makes the traumatic experience so devastating is the sense of being alone. She's discovered that it's far more tolerable and even healing to journey back to the traumatic event with a supportive ally. And this makes me wonder about another, perhaps closely related technique, which might also be helpful. I'm thinking that the patient could be trained to identify one or more positive allies during active imagination. These allies could then be called upon as needed during the PTSD treatment. My idea for this is stimulated not only by Dr. Breslin's approach, but also through my own study of hypnosis, dream work, guided imagery, and shamanic work. I'll have to run this idea by her to see what she thinks. And I will have a chance to discuss this with her because we did have a conversation after the interview about collaborating on developing more continuing education courses through the Zur Institute. As you know, professionals can already earn continuing education units through the Zur Institute by listening to selected Shrink Wrap Radio episodes. On our site, you'll find links to my audio course on dreams and another one on positive psychology. With Sage's help, we'll be adding additional courses for continuing education that draw on the Shrink Wrap Radio library of audio interviews, so stay tuned for that. And getting back to this interview, I'm regretting that I didn't follow up on a couple of interesting tidbits that I let slip by. For example, Sage mentions psychically locating missing persons down to the street. Perhaps I'll have her back on some future episode to discuss some of her more esoteric experiences. I really wanted the focus of today's interview, however, to stay on PTSD. So I made a fairly conscious decision in the moment not to go after some of those juicy and more controversial bits. Once again, Dr. Breslin's website, if you wish to learn more about her very interesting and wide-ranging work, can be found at www.healingheartcenter.org.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Greetings to all you faithful listeners, and to those of you who are new to the show as well. I'm always very gratified to learn that we have new listeners who discover the series with such enthusiasm that they end up going back and listening to them all. And this is becoming an ever more impressive feat, given that we are now up to number 263 with this one, and that's just on Shrink Wrap Radio. If you include my Wise Counsel podcast, we're up over 300 shows. However, I recently learned from one such champion listener in Ireland who let me know that he was unable to listen to some episodes due to broken links. I realized I had stopped paying for a server I'd been using for a while and unwittingly had lost access to a portion of my archives. The episodes in question were numbers 180 through number 192. I'm happy to report that those have now been restored. So if any of you ran into that problem, give it another shot. So big thanks to Justin Lawler in Ireland for alerting me to that problem. And if any of you ever encounter similar difficulties, please do let me know. Now, speaking of the Wise Counsel podcast series, the latest interview there is with Dr. Ellen Walker on child-free living. Being the father of four, I must admit that this is not a topic I'd given much thought to in recent years, but when Dr. Walker let me know of her new book, Complete Without Kids, I realized that this would be an important topic for many out there. I've been getting a fair amount of email from listeners expressing enthusiasm for my recent conversations with my old friend, Jerry Trumbull. He was such a charismatic guy way back when we were both undergraduates, and I have to say, Jerry, my friend, you've still got it. So you can definitely expect to get more Jerry here. When you visit shrinkwrapradio.com, and I hope you will, you will notice some ads in the right-hand sidebar. I'm not sure whether to refer to them as banner ads or badges or what, but you'll see some little square boxes there, aside from the long-running ones for Angie's List for inkjets.com and shoebuy.com, and those corporate sponsors result from my association with mevio.com. In addition to those ads, however, you'll see two others, and these are for listeners who are renting monthly ad space on our site. One is for sobriety.ca, a residential treatment center in Canada, who has found advertising on our site sufficiently valuable as to renew for an additional 2 years on top of the 1 year that they've been on our site already. So thanks to listener Catherine Cosgrove, who is associated with that residential treatment center, Heritage House, for her continued faith and patronage of our site. And let me call to your attention our newest listener slash advertiser, Liz Beck of Liz Beck Designs. Liz is a registered art therapist, web designer, blogger, journal editor, and online marketer who is offering personalized one-to-one web design services, especially targeted to mental health practitioners, guiding them through the process of creating effective and ethical websites. And all of our websites are dynamic, professional, and beautiful, helping you to stand out from the crowd. And she says she offers affordable pricing to meet the needs of any small business. So she'll do not only websites for therapists and so on, but for any small business. And you can get a 10% off her design services using the promo code SHRINK. To view a list of all the services and interactive examples, websites available, you can go to www.lizbeckdesigns.com, or you can just click on her ad in the right-hand sidebar on our site. And if you have a business or service you'd be interested in advertising in a similar fashion, please drop me a line at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com or give me a call at 206-337-0622. Now, I did mention our corporate sponsors where you can get discounts and save money. As I said earlier, when you visit shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and shoebuy.com. I myself have saved money on printer ink several times at 4inkjets.com, and you'll recall that the dress shoes I ordered some time back from shoebuy.com were a bit too large when they arrived, but I was able to send them back for a smaller size for free and no shipping charge. Finally, do help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to create three-way happiness. One, the recipient of your recommendation will be thrilled when they discover the riches here. Two, you will be happy for having exercised your generosity muscles. And three, I will be grateful and happy to have yet another listener. See? Three-way happiness. That should be a dish on a Chinese restaurant menu. And speaking of exercising your generosity muscles, do consider going to our homepage at shrinkwrapradio.com and clicking on the big green donate button. No, don't consider it. Do it. And thanks.
Hi, this is author, filmmaker, and TV host Phil Cousineau, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Phil Cousineau, who will be my guest on our next episode. Well, let's grab a few recent emails. Here's one that just came in today from Igor in Toronto, Canada, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you so much for your wonderful podcasts, Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. I've been a listener for approximately 9 months and have benefited greatly from your thoughtful and engaging interviews. You really have a knack for helping your guests speak about the heart of their research and theories, which I really appreciate. Being exposed to the wide-ranging guests and ideas on your show has not only broadened my understanding of psychology, but has informed my practice of psychotherapy and has thus benefited my clients as well. For this, I'm tremendously grateful. If I may, I have a suggestion for an interview which I think you and your listeners would be interested in. It may fit best with wise counsel. The psychologist's name is Diana Foscia, and her theory of psychotherapy is called AEDP, or Accelerated Experiential Dynamic Psychotherapy. I recently attended a workshop of hers and was very impressed. Her approach is psychodynamic in nature and heavily attachment and relationship-based. She seems to have figured out paths which evoke a person's wired-in attachment system in a way that harnesses a healing potential. This healing potential is released under the right relational and therapeutic conditions. She's been able to take her theory and apply it in practice to a degree and in a way I've not seen by exponents of attachment in psychotherapy. She has a knack of being able to effectively articulate the careful thinking she has done to develop her approach, and this results in a strong intellectual and intuitive resonance in the listener. Her website can be found at www.aedpinstitute.org. Keep up the great work, Dr. Dave, and thanks again. Best regards, and that's from Igor in Toronto, Canada. And Igor, thank you for your very encouraging and supportive feedback and for the suggestion of Diana Foscia. I seem to have seen her name before, and maybe even it's been suggested that she be a guest in the past. I actually thought it sounded so familiar, I thought maybe I had interviewed her already, but I guess not. But after 300 interviews, I'm starting to lose track, or more than 300 interviews, I'm starting to lose track. Next, we hear from Lori in San Diego, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just listened to number 262, A Door into the Unconscious with Jerry Trumbull. Wow, my jaw is hanging open. More, more, more. And right away," and she puts in lots of exclamation marks. She goes on to say, "Oddly enough, or maybe it's synchronistic or being connected at a quantum level, I had just discovered the ability to do the first stages of what Jerry was describing, or something very similar. I had spent about a week laying in bed with one illness or another, so it's similar to the prisoner's cinema situation. What I saw were yellow lights against a green background, and they were moving around. I watched for a while as they made patterns, and then I think I fell asleep. I also slept in many four-hour segments to the point of not knowing if I was waking up at the correct time to get up or not, which is unusual for me. I don't know if that contributed to my noticing this phenomenon. Dreams are of great interest to me, as well as the alternative consciousness experiences you have been exploring in your recent interviews. I'm always seeking to learn or understand more about experiences I've had. The slowing down of time is one of them, and yes, it was a traumatic event. On a crowded boardwalk, a small dog suddenly ran out in front of my bicycle, and I ran him over. He walked away, his owners picked him up, said he was all right, and that I should go on my way, so I don't know if he was hurt, but I would think so. It made me fall off my bike, and that was the part where time slowed down. The strange thing was that it gave me more time to put my hands in just the right place to cushion my fall. I was about 18 at the time and could find no one who understood what I had experienced. I hope you continue with this thread with Jerry. I'm fascinated to know more about it. Your podcasts are a huge service to the world. Thank you so much." And that's from Lori in San Diego. Lori, thanks so much for sharing your experiences and for the feedback on my episode with Jerry Trumbull. And your story about time slowing down is really synchronistic, because I just read an article in The New Yorker, which is becoming my favorite science journal, a really good science-oriented article about that very phenomenon of time slowing down. And I've been meaning to send a copy to Jerry. I think it would provide excellent fodder for a future conversation. And actually, we now have a transcript for episode number 259, The Slippery Slope of Reality, Part 2 with Jerry Trumbull. And that transcript was done by Trina Fink. So, Trina, thanks so much for doing that. Next, we hear from John, who writes, David, you did an absolutely lovely job on the interview with Stan Grof. I had hiked up through the forest near our home to a high rocky knob and listened on my MP3 player while sitting in the sun. For me, it could have gone on for hours longer. I honestly think you could be doing this for NPR or some other big venue if you had the sense to set it up. My best, John. Well, John, I wish I had the sense or the know-how to set it up. There certainly have been other suggestions to that effect, and I'm hoping maybe there'll be a listener who works at NPR at some point who might get that wonderful idea. It would be fun. It would be an honor. Here's one from Michael who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thanks for your podcast. I especially enjoy your conversations with Jerry. Sometimes I feel like listening to you too is like hearing my own thought processes out loud. For quite some time now, I've been interested in diet and lifestyle medicine, which from what I can tell is a scientifically valid alternative to mainstream medicine. I haven't listened to all of your shows, but is it possible that this area has yet to be covered? The term detox actually makes me cringe. People are always ready to fork up cash to rid themselves of, quotes, toxins. So it is not surprising that there are a million products to do this, with advertisements such as uses your body's natural processes to eliminate toxins through your insert body part / organ here. The thing is, there is an organ dedicated to detoxification, the liver, and you can boost its function with a scientifically proven marvel of a substance, broccoli. But eat more broccoli is a hard sell for some reason. I think it's because health professionals don't get excited enough about the effects of vegetables on health, which is why I would like to recommend an interview with Dr. Michael Greger. He really sticks to the science when it comes to health claims, and his enthusiasm for veggies is catchy. He is also a very interesting person, and I would love to see if you could bring out his motivations for living the way he does. For example, everything he publishes is available for free online, but if you want to buy hard copies of his books or DVDs, all the profits go to charity. He lives very simply, adopts animals rather than having kids, wears all used clothes, except I think for his speaking outfits. Quite a character. Thanks for taking the time to read this, if you made it this far. So thank you, Michael, for that suggestion of interviewing Dr. Greger. I'll keep that in mind. And finally, one more. This one from Tom, who shares a link saying, "Hello, I saw this link and it caught my attention, of course, from your recent podcast with Jerry Trumbull about microtubules." And indeed, and that's from Tom. And indeed, it's a very fascinating article and written simply and clearly enough to understand. And it really, for me, shed a new light on my understanding of the microtubules. I saved it using Evernote. And I think Jerry and I might want to discuss this one as well. And the URL is too long to read off the whole thing here. I can just tell you that you can search for it on Google. It appeared in the April 2011 issue of Science Daily. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. On Skype, I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Sage Breslin for sharing her approach today to treating trauma. And on the next episode, my guest will be prolific author and TV producer / interviewer, Phil Cousineau, and we'll be exploring his work on forgiveness and atonement. Until next time, then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.